Welcome to this episode of our podcast series, Future Ready Through M&A. Before we get started, I wanted to take a moment to acknowledge my predecessor, Scott Slater, who served as Vice President, Practice Management at Fidelity Investments. He curated and hosted this podcast series, and I'm honored to be carrying this torch forward after Scott had sailed off into retirement this past January. So Scott, I know that you'll be listening when this podcast airs. Thank you for all that you've done for our M&A program here at Fidelity. This is a true testament to having a successful succession plan in place. And I've appreciated learning from you and appreciated the partnership for the time we worked together. And we all wish you the very best in your new life chapter. I also wanted to take a moment to acknowledge the incredible team we have at Fidelity behind our M&A program. Programs like this require energy, talent, and focus. Thank you to our research, business intelligence, marketing, thought leadership, and communications teams. I'm thrilled to be working for an organization that employs collaboration at this level. In today's discussion, we're joined by Liz Nesvold, president of Crescent Capital, and Michael Nathanson, chair and CEO of the Colony Group. We're going to switch our mindset a bit, and we're going to talk about the five M&A rules to break right now. Introducing those rules, we're going to talk about rule number one, capitalize on high valuations or that fear of missing out. Rule number two, execute M&A when markets are calm. In other words, avoiding M&A in times of uncertainty. Rule number three, sticking to what you know and remaining comfortable. Rule number four, the need to move upscale. Bigger is better. And rule number five, quick integration is key. Enjoy this episode and thank you for listening. Welcome to today's podcast, Five M&A Rules to Break Right Now. For our listeners, quickly introducing myself, I joined Fidelity a year ago after a 16-year career at a respected custodial firm in our industry. I have almost 25 years of industry experience in several roles, and I now serve as Vice President of Practice Management and Consulting at Fidelity Investments, and my name is Laura Delaney. Joining me today are two industry icons and just good human beings. Liz Nesvold has served our industry as a passionate advisor, investment banker, and executive. And she's been honored with many awards, including the M&A Leadership Award and recognized by Investment News Women to Watch. She's built and launched the investment bank Silver Lane Advisors with several partners, including her husband, Peter Nesvold. Silver Lane became a widely recognized top RIA M&A firm, which they sold to a Fortune 500 company in 2019. And she recently joined Crescent Capital as the firm's first ever president, overseeing strategy and holistic services for multi-generational families, M&A, firm-wide integration, and Crescent's 100-year vision. We're excited to see Liz lead Crescent in this next growth chapter, and we're excited to hear Liz's thoughts. So, Liz, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Michael Nathanson is the seeker of the extraordinary and builder of teams and communities. And he's a chair and the CEO of Colony Group, and he just celebrated 19 years there. Colony Group is a solutions-oriented financial services company that addresses clients' financial needs from all areas of their life. He's the host of Seeking the Extraordinary podcast, and that's available on Apple Podcasts, where conversations with guests reveal how their accomplishments, adversaries, ideas, and innovations lead to extraordinary outcomes. He's also the co-author of the book, Personal Financial Planning for Executives and Entrepreneurs, The Path to Financial Peace of Mind, and that's available on Amazon.com. He's the founder of the Nathanson Family Catalyst Fund for Brain Tumor Research, and the Nathanson Family Catalyst Fund for Cardiac Valve Research, and has served on various boards, including the National Brain Tumor Society, Cure GBM, and Pediatric Cancer Cure, and fundraiser and advocate for Boston's Children's Hospital. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you for having me, Laura.
We're super excited for both of you to be here today. M&A has become an essential strategy for firms seeking growth and market expansion and to achieve optimization and scale. And that could be true for both buyer and seller. And there's a lot out there on M&A. There's mechanics, there's trends, and hey, we track it too, right? So there's a lot of talk on culture and making sure you can pass that dinner test. And getting down to the strategic reason why a merger or an acquisition is important. Some would say that M&A has become more mainstream in the wealth management industry over the past, call it, 7 years, and there's a lot of rules on how to do M&A, which there should be. And it's been wonderful that so many trailblazers have paid it forward and shared their best practices. Today, we're going to break those rules. We have some data that we're going to sprinkle in throughout our discussion, but what I'd love about this podcast episode is that we're going to tap into the emotional mindset of M&A. And I'm of the belief that there are two parts to a financial transaction. There's the actual transaction, then there's the emotion behind the transaction. So we have five rules that we're going to break together today, and I can't wait to get your take on it. Our listeners would appreciate some background. So why don't you each take a moment to quickly talk about what your firm is focused on, how many mergers or acquisitions or transactions, and we're sensitive to the word acquisitions, so partnerships that you've been involved with, and how M&A fits into your firm's overall strategy.
So Crescent is a multi-client family office that, while we were founded about 6 years ago, our early roots date back to 1999. We have affected approximately 8 partnerships or combinations. We tend not to talk about acquisitions because we're really looking for like-minded partners who are growth-oriented. And we've also grown organically beautifully, which necessitates looking for additional human capital by all forms, M&A, lift-outs, hirings. So we've been very lucky in that regard to attract wonderful, like-minded colleagues. As an organization, we really have a vision for perpetuating the partner model. And our two co-founders came up with a 100-year vision for the business. And a big part of my role is to ensure that we perpetuate that. Yesterday was my 100th day on the job.
Oh, congratulations.
So if you asked me, thank you. If you asked me 100 days ago, what would I be doing? I said, give me 100 days. Here I am, 100 days in, and I have better visibility on what I'm doing to perpetuate that model. And it's really to help thinking about all aspects of how we do what we do, because at the end of the day, it's all about the clients. This is an intangible asset business, and we can't forget that. But just so pleased to be associated with a firm that today we have about $40 billion in assets with 8 partnerships under our belt.
That's wonderful. Let's hear from you, Michael.
So the Colony Group is a national wealth and business management firm with over 20 offices across the country. I want to build on what Liz said, with which I fully agree, in that we don't prefer the term acquisition, perhaps for a slightly different reason, though I think Liz and I see things in a similar way, in that we like to think of them as mergers when they are legally mergers, in that it's not one firm taking over another firm, but rather two firms coming together to do something together that they could not do individually on their own. In other words, we have a better than before philosophy. We must make our merger partner better. Our merger partner must make us better. We've done 16 mergers and 3 strategic hires. So these strategic hires are when an advisor or group of advisors is able to leave, because their covenants allow them to do so, a prior employer, and bring their clients to the Colony Group and its platform. We also have a financial partner, and that is Focus Financial Partners. And so I would say to you that we have the experience not only of being on the buyer side, but also on the seller side, because when we did the Focus transaction, we were in that role instead. So Focus is our financial partner, and we work together in partnership to bring other firms with us. Ultimately, what I would say for this purpose is that what fuels our quest for growth, not only organically, but inorganically, is a desire to embrace interdependence. This notion that even in a world that speaks about independent advisors, the great strength that we all can derive from interdependence, I think, is largely untapped. It's this concept of bringing people together, bringing firms together to have broader perspectives, broader capabilities. It does require a willingness to give up some control which is something that people have a hard time with in our industry. Nevertheless, we believe that the rewards very much outweigh the costs.
All right, so let's get into it. Let's start breaking some rules together. Let's get into rule number one. We're going to talk about capitalizing on high valuations or that fear of missing out, that FOMO. And there's certainly FOMO out there in the marketplace. Fidelity, we just released our valuation and deal structure study with 30 strategic acquirers who participated, and they provided their insights, and we gained some tremendous data from that study. We learned that the median EBITDA multiple for firm valuation for mergers and acquisitions in the REA space increased by 2 turns from 7 times EBITDA to 9 times EBITDA, but sellers wanted 11. And that was comparing the study we did back in 2019 to the study we did in 2023. So we had some nice trending data there. So looking at where we are now, the equities markets have made a nice recovery. They're up about 17% year to date. And we're seeing that valuations are holding high for high quality firms. Liz, what's your take on firm owners wanting to get something done when there may be an element of that FOMO, that fear missing out on high valuations?
I'm sorry to laugh, but I've been hearing that for, gosh, I've been a 30-year M&A practitioner, and probably most of those years, everybody is always worried they're going to miss out. You know, to take a step back, transactions, it's not static. So you don't get a pile of cash at close and people hope that you show up the next day. Invariably, there's an element of value paid at close and value paid over time. So often it is a function of, you know, those multiples. I'll do better if I lean in and I can find ways to grow and the deal is structured well. And somebody on the buy side may think that they actually paid 7 times. So, and someone on the sell side may think they received 9 times. So it's all a function of deal mechanics, structuring, and the like. In terms of jumping in because you're worried about pricing, the reality is quality firms that partner with other quality firms with thought on the holistic approach should always take a look at what's happening in the marketplace. Pricing may have gotten people to lift their heads, but the reality is there's so much continuity planning that has to happen within the industry that more people need to spend their time being prepared. You can't just jump in and say, hey, let's do this. There are steps to being ready, you know, on the buy side. Why are you doing this? What does your partner criteria look like? How will you gauge whether this is a good transaction? Beyond, you know, cultural fit, it's hard to gauge that in one date. So you need some time to think that through. Are you enhancing a service offering? Back to what Michael said, we want to partner with folks who are going to make us better together. And really, you know, when is it the right time to walk away? You have to make sure you have those framed out in your head with your team before you come to the table. So I wouldn't jump in because we're worried that the multiple may go down one, because we did one combination and one of the earlier transactions, and the key principle there just said, the equity that I hold in Crescent has now become, again, my most valuable asset. And he took about 30% in equity, 70% in cash. So if you structure the right deal, there's still value to be gained. So it's not about waiting now, tomorrow, for that last nickel and worrying about missing that nickel.
That's great. Really good perspective. And Michael, same question for you.
Well, I love your reference to FOMO. And when we as human beings feel fear, we should ask ourselves why we feel fear. Fear is an evolutionary trait that we have, and it tells us that there's something we should be thinking about. Is there danger? Is there danger in acting? Is there danger in not acting? So when we feel these feelings, it is a good opportunity to reflect on why we are not participating in the M&A markets, or why we are. And I think we also have to reflect on why we are seeing higher valuations. There's been a confluence of events. We've seen the maturation of the so-called independent advisory industry, not fully mature, but certainly a more mature industry. We see, if you believe in the the business curve that you see for various industries. We've certainly moved up the curve. And what's happened is that PE has seen that, and they've entered into the marketplace. And that's part of what is driving up valuations. The long-term perspective on the industry has become more attractive. And with more prospects for growth and higher expectations for the future, valuations often can go up and should go up. And once again, it comes back to, do you believe that ultimately embracing interdependence is the key to long-term sustainability? Do you believe in evolution? Do you believe you have all of the answers right now? And if you do, well, then there's no need for you to evolve. I would suggest no one has all the answers. And I view the trend toward increased combinations and increased M&A activity as part of individual evolution and the evolution of the industry itself. I've spoken many times about economic Darwinism, and Darwin never spoke about the survival of the fittest. What Darwin spoke about was the survival of the species, the organisms that are best able to adapt to changes in the environment. Those that can adapt thrive. Those that cannot adapt are naturally selected for extinction. I think it's very similar in our industry.
That's outstanding and really puts a new perspective on Darwinism. And I think the sort of the cliche that we've all heard over time for the wealth management industry, super vibrant industry, right? We're seeing more RIA firms formed each year than are being acquired. But before we leave this topic, I wanted to get back to private equity because it was mentioned a few times in both of your responses. I just wanted to throw the question out there. Is there FOMO from the private equity perspective? Is that a real thing?
I would say, yes, there is a little bit of that.
Right.
We talk about private equity in this industry as sort of the third wave. The first wave of entrants are those who really have developed funds around, let's say, asset and wealth management, and they're laser focused in our domain. The second wave are those that have maybe a vertical dedicated to financial services. And then the third wave is everybody else who may think of this as a business service. So there is a fair amount of capital into the space, but with the FOMO comes pushes to move into opportunities that may involve what we call superstructure deals, things like PIC preferreds, also called PAC band preferreds, because it's a high yield for protection as a minority interest partner. You have to be very careful about the partner. It's just like what Michael and I do in terms of gauging cultural compatibility and fit and combination on merger. You want to make sure that you understand the objective of the private equity partner, since they are aplenty right now, and that there's a good fit with their structure versus what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, and I would just add that I don't think it is actually FOMO for PE. I think PE is much more objective, much more analytical in terms of thinking about objective criteria. And I think what PE is doing is exploiting the inefficiencies that have existed in this industry and exploiting them not just for the benefit of their investors, but certainly for the benefit of the firms in which they are investing and all of their stakeholders. So much happens in other areas of a free market system. People come in and find inefficiencies, find ways to take advantage of those inefficiencies. And the benefit of that, if you believe in the truly capitalistic structure, is that in turn, these inefficiencies are eradicated and you ultimately see a maturation of the industry in a more efficient industry. I believe that's really the role of private equity. And just to mirror what Liz said, I think it's welcome. I know it's scary to some people. And if you're not in a place where you're participating with a funding partner, or if you're someone who feels that, well, we don't need to do anything differently, we've been doing something for the last three decades a certain way, and it's just fine, and everyone's happy, I can understand that fear. I think it's more fear within the advisory community than within the PE community.
Love the two sides of the coin there, perspective. Let's go to rule number two. execute M&A when markets are calm. So in other words, avoiding M&A in times of uncertainty. I'm here quoting the Investment Advisor Association and NRS. There are roughly 15,000 SEC-registered RIA firms, and this number continues to grow. And we read in headlines, and Fidelity's quoted here too, that M&A is up and M&A is down, right? So exactly. But investment bankers, through conversations I have with them, they tell me that sellers sometimes become skittish when they're reading these headlines. Michael, I'd love to start with you. What's your take on executing M&A only when everything is calm and predictable?
Human beings are human beings, and I do consider myself to be a student of human nature. And despite the fact that one of the most important things that many advisors, I won't say all advisors, say is don't try to time the markets. There are advisors who do believe in market timing, and that's great, more power to them. But as the cliche goes, the Market Timers Hall of Fame is an empty room. If Warren Buffett can't market time, you've got to have a lot of confidence to think that you can. And I think so it goes with M&A as well. This notion of timing the markets and getting it perfect, good luck with that. It's not likely that you will. But, you know, hey, you know, some people feel like it's better to be lucky than to be smart. When the markets are volatile, that means something is going on in the system, and it might very well be the perfect time to either be a buyer or to be a seller. Perhaps a buyer can extract better pricing. Perhaps a seller can see greater benefit in sustainability and in reducing volatility by being part of something larger. Ultimately, though, what I would say is this. If you are someone who is a pure quant, and you're thinking only about money, and that's not, in my opinion, a healthy way to be thinking about mergers. Money, of course, matters. But as I said, there should be other reasons to engage in M&A, not just money. But if you are a pure quant, what I would say is this. If the time is right for all of the good reasons, such as whether this makes us better than before, such as whether our stakeholders need it, then it's quite simple to structure a deal to account for that volatility. That is, the amount of upfront consideration can change. You can have earnout structures or variable consideration structures that are tied to revenue, tied to minimum levels of revenue, tied to retaining clients, and certainly tied to growth as well. There are infinite ways to structure a transaction. And so if the time is right, the idea of waiting for the markets to be calm is, well, with due respect, it's a bit lazy.
And to add on to that, if I had a dollar for every time somebody said, boy, you really top ticked that one, I'd probably have at least $50, because the answer is exactly what Michael highlighted. There's an old saying in the business, you name the price and I'll set the terms. There's always a price tag that somebody may have in their mind, but invariably it comes back to great structuring. So it isn't about this moment or if the market takes a downturn, we're going to miss the opportunity. There's always ways to do lookbacks and true ups. You know, more currency today is starting to tilt in equity currency too. So that means you're not capitalizing at a point in time. There's an opportunity to create additional value as well. And if you think back to the financial crisis, some of the largest names that we know today in the business really leaned in with good capitalization coming out of the financial crisis. And they did it growing organically and via combination with our own firm that we sold in April 2019. We headed into COVID. We would not have known that. But my team of 15 or 16 did 50 deals in 48 months. And I can't even tell you how many of those deals were done with people that we were seeing over, you know, digital engagement. Zoom and Teams became our best friend. And so one would have thought that during COVID, you know, deals weren't going to happen. Again, another crisis. And while there was a rebound back on that, people were leaning in and engaging, knowing that they still had a mandate. There was still a need for this. and maybe even a bigger need with uncertainty for some of the sellers to ensure that they could shore things up, find the right partner, set the right structure, and make sure that good value could be conveyed despite crazy market times.
So it really comes down to having a good deal structure and thinking for the longer term. Let's break rule number three together, sticking to what you know and remaining comfortable. Liz, what's your take on remaining comfortable?
I would break down the statement into remaining comfortable versus sticking to what you know, because I think, you know, remaining comfortable always reminds me of resting on your laurels. It's either up or out in this industry. This is a wonderful business of recurring fees and clients that if you do what you say you're going to do, stay with you for, let's say it's 97, 98% retention. That is a great cash flowing business. So could you remain comfortable? Of course. Do you run the risk that clients don't stick with you if you are not continually reinvesting or looking at what the market holds and what your clients are telling you? Sometimes you can get very deep in subject matter, like you could be the best trust and estate planning group. You could be excellent on tax planning and compliance. You could be a wonderful planner. But if your clients are saying we need more, you need to think about that. And so when you think about M&A in that context, only 2 to 3% of this industry transacts in every given year, and it continues to replenish. It was 8,000 firms when I started in this industry, and we've got, I don't know, 15, 16, did you say 1,000 today? So I did a terrible job consolidating the industry, apparently, in my former role. But you can stay in what you do, but you can't rest on your laurels. You need to think about how you continue to evolve. And also this generation. And this generation of talent doesn't want to be in a position where there is no upward mobility. So there are a variety of reasons to think about that. And if you're a growing firm and you have some deficits in human capital, meaning you don't have enough people, or your clients are telling you we need more robust wealth strategist work or deeper family office services, there's got to be some way to think about that because the clients will find it otherwise. So it could be by partnership, hiring, merger, some form of relationship elsewhere. But you can be deep and continue to evolve, or you can expand your offering and not be comfortable. Comfortable is the key word that makes me nervous.
Michael, I know you have a unique position on this particular topic. I'd love to hear what you think about remaining comfortable.
I do. I have passion around it. And here I will use the word fear. There's fear in me as well around this. I've been the CEO of the Colony Group for over 17 years. And in that period of time, I have been comfortable on 0 days. I've been uncomfortable for every single day, including weekends. Why is that? Because as much success as we've had and as much pride as we could have in what we have built, and I do feel pride around that, I'm also mindful of the countless stories of companies like Nokia. You know, back in the day when cell phones were becoming mainstream, Nokia owned about 50% of the cell phone market. That is the kind of market domination you rarely see ever in any place. And they owned the market. They had virtually no competitors. I'm a big fan of the Matrix movies because I'm a science fiction fan. And if you remember the really cool cell phones that Morpheus and Neo and all those characters had, they were Nokia phones. That's the penetration of that company. And today, if you're a young person, you've never heard of Nokia. Why is that? Because Nokia got too comfortable, because they forgot to evolve. They forgot to innovate. They forgot to be paranoid. And then, yeah, this company comes around that made cool computers. And the next thing you know, they're in the cell phone space. And another company that was a search engine company decides to come up with this really cool platform. And Apple and Google put Nokia out of business before Nokia even saw it coming. That will happen in our industry as well if any of us get too comfortable. Again, it's hard not to feel comfortable in our industry. As Liz said, we can get comfortable because, let's face it, if you do a great job for your clients and your clients appreciate what you're doing, most clients will be clients for life. That's where you're giving them what they want, and that's great. But what about what they're going to want tomorrow or the next day? I like to think about the Fidelity Advice Value Stack.
Love that you're referencing that.
Yeah, and I'm not, you know, I'm not just saying that because I'm speaking to someone from Fidelity. I speak about that all the time, and I think about it. This concept of managing money at the bottom of that pyramid is, of course, fundamental. It's the base. It's important. Achieving goals is more differentiated, and clients perceive even greater value as you get to that. But then you have to think about the next two levels of that advice value stack: achieving peace of mind and ultimately achieving fulfillment. And clients want fulfillment. They want peace of mind. They want achieving goals, and they want their money to be managed well. This is one of the main reasons, again, why we pursue mergers. It's to be better, broader, deeper, to gain new capabilities, and to gain new perspectives. It's all part of that evolution so that we do not become the next Nokia or Kodak or Polaroid, and I could go on. There's a long list of those companies.
I love that you referenced the advice value stack from Fidelity, and you speak to it so well. So I'm glad
and
that
I will
has
say for the record, I was not paid to do so.
No, you were. We've never even discussed it. that was phenomenal. Well done. And I wanted to touch on fear because it has come up a few times, and I do have to give credit where credit's due. But I do quote Chris Voss, and he is a former FBI hostage negotiator who's turned his practices into the business world. He is very good at negotiation and has some really good courses around it. But he will always say that human nature is just fear. And 70% of all decisions made, whether it's a decision or an indecision, which is still a decision, it's made out of fear. Let's round out, and we're going to go into rule number four, the need to move upscale. Bigger is better. So according to our Fidelity Valuation and Deal Structure study, the median size advisory firm in M&A transactions, RIA M&A transactions, rose to $400 million from $250 million. And our tracking suggests that those billion-dollar plus deals in purchase assets have made a comeback in the first half of 2023. And that's to around 35% of the deals that we tracked were over $1 billion. So the question here is, does bigger mean a better firm? And what should interested suitors have their eyes on? Michael, during one of your recent podcast episodes on the podcast that you host, you started talking about having the end in mind and asking, what does your company stand for? Are you just trying to make a bunch of money? So what is your take on the notion of trying to hit X dollars in assets under management?
I believe if you go back and roll back the tape, I didn't even mention our assets under management. Yeah, begin with the end in mind is actually one of the seven habits of highly effective people in the book by Stephen Covey. And what Stephen Covey was talking about was not begin the next project with the end in mind. It's not begin the next merger with the end in mind. It's begin the rest of your life with your end in mind. That's really what he's talking about. And what he says is, what will people say about you at your funeral? What will people say about you when you're long gone? And to me, a legacy of building a large company, I would describe it as an incomplete legacy, at least from my perspective. This is a personal perspective. What I want is to be part of something extraordinary. What I want is to be part of something that's made a difference in the world, that's had a positive impact in the world. We've made a pledge we call the net positive pledge, which is to give more to the world than we take. We ask ourselves the question, is the world a better place because our company is in it? So as we think about bigger being better, that's an absolute statement. Those of you who are Star Wars fans, and I am an unabashed Star Wars fan, know that only a Sith deals in absolutes. to say bigger is better is it's a pretty absolute rule. I think bigger can be better, and I think bigger can actually lead to bad things as well. For us, I think it's better. For us, I think about it in terms of scale, capability, impact, you know, going back to that legacy, and efficiency. For me, I've often said that in this industry, I think there's an evolution from practice to collaborative, which is just a group of practices that work together loosely, may put a name, the same name in the door, but they're really separate practices, to business. A business is a collection of practices where everyone has the same mission, vision, values, and most people think it ends there, but there's something beyond business. That's enterprise. Liz talked about having a 100-year vision. No company is going to be around for 100 years unless it's an enterprise. It must have the characteristics of an enterprise. It has to be able to endure even beyond the individual people that make up the organizations. But that being said, there are lots of reasons why, you know, some larger companies are not run in a sustainable fashion. If they're run irresponsibly, if they're run just for the sake, growth for growth's sake, and you do see this out there, I don't think that's a sustainable model. I think it will implode. And I think that you can still do great things and have great impact as a smaller organization if you are still evolving. I don't ever claim M&A is the only way to evolve and to get better. It is one way to do that. Smaller organizations that are open and curious and have the ability to embrace new opportunities and new perspectives can certainly achieve greatness and great impact as well. There's a book called Small Giants by Bo Burlingham, and I strongly recommend that for those that intentionally choose to stay small. One last thing, and then I'll turn it over to Liz. This concept of bigger being better. Let's all have some perspective as well. The largest RIAs in our industry in the real world aren't that large. I mean, just look at Fidelity relative to the size of even the largest RIAs. We have large firms in the industry, among the largest, but the industry is not exactly full of large firms if we have the perspective of looking outside our industry.
That's well said. And if we're thinking about, I don't have the number off the top of my head, but you know, trillions of dollars under management and how big registered investment advisory firms are, it's small relative to the amount of money that's under management. But Liz, let's hear from you.
Gosh, I could just say what he said. because I agree. Michael and I go way back. And in fact, as you were talking the other day, Michael, about the first deal I banked, it was one of Silver Lane's first deals. And I can't even believe it's been so long. But he's spot on. When we think about the sizing of this marketplace, I mean, we're really in the third inning of our evolution. There are larger firms than others. But bigger isn't better necessarily. I do think that done well, managed well in a partnership format, bigger firms can have deeper resources that can benefit clients, create opportunities for employees. But we like to think about it as big firm resources and a boutique delivery. I like the fact that the industry continues to evolve. And, you know, at the end of the day, if we're really going to deliver on a 100-year vision, we do have to be an enterprise that continues to innovate, that continues to bring on colleagues. Because for us, it is about bringing people into the fold that want to become partners, creating a market to be able to provide liquidity to partners so that it isn't just about some subsequent event, because we envision ourselves as an independent firm over these years doesn't mean we won't take capital at some point to continue to evolve. To Michael's point, I love that he didn't give the AUM. It is one metric. So it isn't just about being bigger. And this tying this back into M&A, doing deals to be bigger does not compute to me. It never did. This is why I'm in the perfect place, because we will never be. We're number one foam finger in any year on the number of deals. Doing deals because you bring in partners who make you better, help you perpetuate your partnership model, help you serve clients better, is worthwhile all day long and twice on Sunday. So everything Michael said is absolutely what I would have echoed. And, you know, I'm pleased to be where we are. I expect that we'll continue to evolve, but we're not here to be bigger. We're here to be better.
Let's wrap up with our last rule. Rule number 5, quick integration is key. And there's no doubt that we all want to be efficient. And Liz, I recently heard you on a podcast episode that you were featured on, and it was hosted by RIA Edge and Mark Bruno. You talked about integration. You mentioned some key things which resonated with me. You said that integration is the first measure of a new partnership.
Thank you for reminding me. You know, it really is. It's the first experience someone's going to have with your organization. So don't break it, right? Don't break it. Invariably, I mean, we're an organization that will be fully integrated. We're one Crescent. Doesn't mean every single thing is going to be always the HQ way, but you have to be thoughtful and methodical. We're not 100% integrated. If you don't map things out in advance, if you don't work with your new partners to get colleague interaction between peers, it starts with a tough relationship. You know, I'm no longer the shoemaker's wife because we went through our own partnership and combination. And bigger institutions with investment banking, I mean, that's full integration and was full integration fast. And we had to integrate ourselves. That's not a great way to start your relationship necessarily. So to the extent that if you've never done a deal before, seek help. There are a lot of wonderful people in the community that serve as advisors, post-merger consultants. You know, even you all do a ton of work to help people think about planning for that first event. But, you know, for us, it's thinking about legal day one. So we've commenced our deal. You've gone through client consent. And here we are together. There are some things that will make sense right up front. We don't want to surprise anybody that HR and compliance benefits, we're going to map over legal, financial management. It doesn't mean we yank it out of your hand and we move it over and we work together. Just like Michael had articulated, a number of our leaders came by way of partnership. So in some cases, it could be this is the person who is our partner, who is the smaller firm that will succeed in terms of a role. And we've added additional roles. We've had financial management, compliance in multiple jurisdictions. It doesn't mean it's all just at HQ. But you have to map it out very carefully. Let people know in advance what's a legal day one requirement. Work with them on the mapping. Not everything goes, if you've done a bajillion deals, not everything should go the same way that your template operated previously. You have to be prepared to listen and make some accommodations because it truly is. It is the first time someone's going to get to know your organization, and how they experience that combination will set the tone for the rest of the partnership and their younger colleagues. So make it a good experience.
Very good. Thanks, Liz. Michael.
It's just not that simple. In some ways, sure, integration should be quick. Liz mentioned some of the areas. For us, compliance immediately. Finance immediately, payroll, human resources. There are certain things that technology has to all be done right away. But there are other things like investments, for example, that are going to need to wait. And there are reasons for that. If indeed we are all fiduciaries, we need to be thinking about what's in the client's best interest. And often, for example, turning over portfolios can recognize gain. It can create disturbances. And while it might be more efficient, we must be bound by doing what's right for clients. And then there are areas where I don't believe ever get integrated. We can try to integrate the way we all provide advice to clients, but it's a very individual thing. Sure, the ultimate deliverable might look the same across the firm, but the way it's delivered will definitely vary. And that will vary depending on, in some cases, 30 or 40 years of experience. You're not going to have an advisor that's been doing something a certain way for decades, you know, suddenly say, okay, now I'm going to do it very differently. It just isn't going to happen. And I would submit to you it's a good thing. Because if we truly think of ourselves as entrepreneurs and not as just advisors, then I'd like to adopt a saying that I learned from my colleagues at Focus, which is never convert a successful entrepreneur into an employee. Employees are important. It's a great thing to have. But you know, when you have someone who's got true entrepreneurial spirit, don't snuff it out. And then I want to say something else, because you mentioned early, Laura, culture. And I want to say something about that. People often say to me, well, how do you keep the culture the same across all of the offices? To which I reply, God forbid, I don't want to keep the culture the same across. That just sounds dreadful. And what I would tell you is this, I believe that a company of our size can have a national culture. For us, I would articulate it as containing three principles: kindness, placing super teams before superstars. And then the third aspect is awareness. We want our people to all have awareness around how they show up, when they're in drama, when they're committed to their truths, when they're open to learning. Just having awareness around it and not judging each other, as long as we can just talk about it. That's it. Each office, whether organically or inorganically established, will have its own culture. And I got news for you. Firms that say, oh, the culture is the same across the firm, they're lying to themselves. I'm not saying maliciously. Every office will have its own subculture. And why can't we just celebrate that? Why can't we learn from these subcultures and just, you know, consider them another form of diversity that in turn feeds into this notion of being an enterprise? So I view that as a strength. I view that as a form of corporate multiculturalism. And so I don't think culture ever fully gets integrated.
I love that. And you said the word diversity. I was actually typing the word diversity. I was going to bring it up. But I would think that you'd want to have the firm have a same mission, right? But naturally have different cultures around their different offices. And that creates diversity.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, before we go, let's lightning round here. According to our valuation and deal structure study, it pointed to 2/3 of the participants, or 60% of the participants, plan to do more deals in the next 5 years. So what are your plans? Liz, I know that you're going around, you're having conversations with everybody that you're meeting in different areas and asking what's working and what's not working. And so what are your plans for M&A in the future?
I am 100 days into that journey. I haven't met everybody yet. We still have some offices to go. But a big part of the review is to understand where we have capacity constraints, where we are really needing to lean into additional service offerings or maybe more robust service offerings. And that will inform the M&A side of the equation. That said, you can't make it so superscript and formulaic, meaning, okay, I've identified a gap, now let's go fill it. We listen. We listen all the time. There are some wonderful firms out there. But to Michael's point, it really has to be additive. I absolutely agree with you. You have single mission and vision. There will be some cultural leanings in different offices that will be a little bit different. And we shouldn't try to change everybody and can them. But that being said, we're going to do more combinations when we find the right fit. We'll do them because the clients have a need. Otherwise, we're just going to be laser focused on growing organically.
Thanks. Michael?
We have been labeled by some as a serial acquirer, and I vehemently object to that. We are a firm that does mergers to get better than before, to be better than before, and to help our merger partners be better than before. We, every 3 years, engage in a vivid vision process. There's a book by Cameron Herold called Vivid Vision. It's really a booklet. It's very short. And it describes this process of every 3 years thinking about where you want to be and how you want to be seen in 3 years. The thinking is that 5 years, the world changes so much, that's too far out. 1 year is not enough time. So think in 3-year increments. And so every 3 years, we write out in detail and vivid colors with pictures and maps where we want to be, what we want our capabilities to be, what we want our people to be, whom we want to be on our team, whom we want to be our business partners. And when we do mergers, we do them to help us get to our vivid vision. So we know where we want to be, the geographies where we're not where we want to be. We know what capabilities we want to continue to add. We know what kind of people we want to continue to add. And so that informs our M&A strategy. We most certainly will continue to do mergers. Mergers in some ways, just on that last part, just bringing on great people, it's a very efficient way to, quote, hire, end quote, great people. Going out and doing it one person at a time is very difficult in a very challenging talent market. And mergers is a great way to bring in next generation talent, new talent, different talent, more diverse talent. So we think about it that way. We will continue to do mergers, but we will not do it just for the sake of getting larger. We do not believe in growth for growth's sake. It's growth to become better.
Yeah, it's all about being intentional. Well, thank you both so much. This was an incredible discussion. On behalf of Fidelity, we thank you for taking the time to be here and for sharing your perspectives.
Oh, thank you for having us. And Michael, so great to see you and be with you.
You too, my friend.
I look forward to seeing you soon.
Reference citations for this episode: Investment Advisor Industry Snapshot 2023 Report, Investment Advisor Association 2023. The 2023 Fidelity M&A Valuation and Deal Structure Study is based on data from firms consisting of M&A leaders, forum members, and other clients identified as doing M&A who participated in an online survey conducted by Fidelity Investments. 26 RIAs and 4 COI Center of Influence firms participated in the survey. The survey was fielded from February 13th through March 28th, 2023, and covered M&A deals between January 2020 and March 2023. The 2019 study covered M&A deals between January 2017 and July 2019. 23 firms participated in the study. Throughout the report, the approximate median has been calculated using the midpoint of the range where the actual median falls. For investment professional use or institutional investor use only. Information provided in and presentation of this document are for informational and educational purposes only and are not a recommendation to take any particular action or any action at all, nor an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities or services presented. It is not investment advice. Fidelity does not provide legal or tax advice. Before making any investment decisions, you should consult with your own professional advisors and take into account all of the particular facts and circumstances of your individual situation. Fidelity and its representatives may have a conflict of interest in the products or services mentioned in these materials because they have a financial interest in them and receive compensation, directly or indirectly, in connection with the management, distribution, and/or servicing of these products or services, including Fidelity funds, certain third-party funds and products, and certain investment services. The third-party providers listed herein are neither affiliated with nor an agent of Fidelity and are not authorized to make representations on behalf of Fidelity. Their input herein does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information was provided by the third-party providers and is subject to change. The content provided and maintained by any third-party website is not owned or controlled by Fidelity. Fidelity takes no responsibility whatsoever nor in any way endorses any such content. There is no form of legal partnership, agency, affiliation, or similar relationship among an investment professional, the third-party service providers, and Fidelity Investments, nor is such a relationship created or implied by the information herein. Third-party trademarks and service marks are the property of their respective owners. All other trademarks and service marks are the property of FMR LLC or its affiliated companies. Fidelity Investments provides investment products through Fidelity Distributors Company, LLC, clearing custody or other brokerage services through National Financial Services, LLC, or Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Members NYSE SIPC. Copyright 2023 FMR, LLC. All rights reserved. 1094952.1.0. 1.99108.0.100.